as we phrase it here, is ancient ethics for troubled times. You should each you handouts all around here as well. So we'll kind of work through the handout a little bit so we can kind of flip through it together as we go along. So,
John Hamilton, we only made so many, so if you guys could share, is there anybody who needs one?
As long as there's somebody beside you who has one, you can look at it together there. All right, so everybody's able to see the handout. We're okay there. So the title, Ancient Ethics for Troubled Times, I spent some time thinking over that phrasing, troubled times. Because there's a lot of stuff going on in our culture right now, and troubled times is a fairly okay phrase, I think, to use for some of the stuff we're dealing with. But I was thinking, well, if we went back 20 or 30 or 40 years, let's say go back to when Vietnam was happening and, you know, you had the civil rights movement and a president resigning and another president was just assassinated. And you would definitely hear people saying, well, these are troubled times, right? If we go back 100 years, people are going to be saying the same thing. Wow, this is rough, right? World War I, troubled times. We go back 500 years, 1,000 years, 2,000 years. You're going to hear the same thing, right? There's a consistency there. Well, there's some troubled times for humanity. So the question was arising in me, okay, so if troubled times is consistent across what we know of human history, then we're not in a unique situation. You know, we're just in the human situation. We're in the human condition. And so we have to learn to deal with the human condition. Now, every age has their uniqueness in the challenges. You know, 100 years ago, they didn't have to deal with the technological age. So there's details that differ, but the essence is essentially the same, right? So I was thinking, okay, so why are there troubles? Who's causing trouble? Right? It's not the vegetable kingdom. It's not the animals. The earth's not causing trouble. We're causing trouble. We're the troublemakers. So we're put in this position where we are both the troublemakers and simultaneously we need to come up with a solution for ourselves. This is the big dilemma that we're in. We're not like a parent who's got it all figured out and the kid's struggling and causing trouble and you come in and, no, it's ourselves. That's the tough part about what we're dealing with here. So, okay, so troubled times, cross history, human beings are the troublemakers. So why are we troublemakers? Right? That's the big question. And that's kind of the kind of question that the wise men and sages and philosophers of the ages have asked. Well, what is it in us that's making us cause so much trouble? And when you start exercising the second object of the Theosophical Society, when you start investigating the traditions from all around the world, you find roughly the same kind of answer. And usually, it boils down to ignorance. Primary cause. All the trouble stems from there and kind of reverberates out. So we have this sort of fundamental ignorance in ourselves that we need to try find some kind of solution for. And that's kind of the next step that these wise men and philosophers tackle is, okay, so we've got this ignorance going on. We think we're separate from one another. We think we're this body. We're under all these layers of illusion. And in addition to that, we have this, what Socrates would refer to as double ignorance. Not only are we ignorant, but we're ignorant of our own ignorance. So we're ignorant and we think we have it all figured out. It's a pretty big problem that we're facing. And because troubled times have gone all across history, apparently we haven't solved it yet. So I'm going to solve it for you here now, in the next few minutes. So if ignorance is a fundamental problem, then what's the fundamental solution? This is a very Vedanta question, a Vedanta tradition from India. They'll often phrase it, okay, if ignorance is the problem, the solution is knowledge, right? So that's what we need. But it's not just knowledge as in, well, let's read a few books, figure out some theoretical things about, I don't know, the universe and how things work and yada yada. No, it's knowledge in action, right? What we essentially need is we need the kind of knowledge that plays itself out in the world in a way that solves the troublemaking or allows us to, let's say, coexist a little more harmoniously than we're currently doing. So this knowledge, this kind of knowledge in action, or you could say applied wisdom or those kinds of terms, that's the working definition I always use for ethics. You know, that's essentially what ethics is, right? In a sense, you can't really be ethical without knowledge. You can try to be good, right? And you'll put in lots of effort into being good. But if you don't have the wisdom behind the action, most often you end up causing more trouble than you intended. Good intentions, not necessarily great results. Is that highway to hell statement go? Yeah? What's it paved in?
Yeah.
So we need some knowledge, and we need applied knowledge. So that's kind of what we'll work through here a little bit. We're going to do a little bit of a survey of some of these traditions from around the world. We're going to try to find some way of sort of synthesizing those. And we're going to try to find, well, how does this apply? Like, how do we bring these kinds of ideas into action in life? So let's start with... let's start with a story. Does anybody know who Alcibiades is?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a dialogue written by Plato about... called Alcibiades, and it's a conversation between Socrates and essentially like an arrogant young kid who thought he had it all figured out. You know, he wanted to get into politics. He was looking at all the politicians and he was saying, like, they don't know what they're doing. They're causing all kinds of problems. I know what I'm doing. I got the answer. I'm going to get into politics and sort things out. Luckily, he met Socrates. And Socrates started asking him questions. And it didn't take long, as it normally didn't take long with most of them in Socrates' presence, for him to be pretty drastically disabused of his arrogance. So he was exposed to a wise man, right? And that exposure to that wise man helped him overcome this ignorance to some degree and develop a bit of practical knowledge that he could bring into life. The other story I really like comes from India, and it's the same story. The arrogant young kid there is named Shvetaketu, and he thinks he has it all figured out because he memorized the Vedas. And he goes to this sage, and he's gonna like tell the sages what's what. And I think it only took three questions, might even four questions, from the sage before Shvetaketu realized he had no idea what was going on. The sage looked at him and said, "Do you know about karma and reincarnation?" And he went, "What?" Okay, memorizing the Vedas didn't really solve that problem for him. So humanity is that kid. You know, we're that young, arrogant kid. And we need exposure to these wise men. Luckily, we have it. I mean, there's no shortage of wise men in human history. There's no shortage of wise men in the world today. There's lots we can draw upon to disabuse us of our arrogance and thinking that we have everything all figured out. So this is something that HPB directs us towards. And I'm just going to read a couple quotes on the front page of the handout there for you. When asked about ethics and about what kind of ethics does theosophy teach, this is what HPB had to say. The question is, have you any ethical system that you carry out in the Theosophical Society? And she replies, "The ethics are there, ready and clear enough for whomever would follow them. They are the essence and cream of the world's ethics, gathered from the teachings of all the world's great reformers. Therefore, you will find them represented there in Confucius and Zoroaster, Lao Tzu and the Bhagavad Gita, the precepts of Gautama Buddha and Jesus of Nazareth, of Hillel and his school, as of Pythagoras, Socrates, Plato, and their school." She was a little bit later asked, "Which system do you prefer or follow in that case, besides Buddhistic ethics?" They knew she was a little bit Buddhist, so they asked this question. Huh? "None and all," is her answer. "We hold to no religion, as to no philosophy in particular. We cull the good we find in each." And we'll do a little bit of that culling now. That's how we'll try to work through things. So HPB didn't spoon feed us an ethical system. She didn't say, here it is, just go and put it into action. She wants us to figure it out for ourselves. And it's the exercise of figuring it out for ourselves that actually develops that knowledge and wisdom in ourselves. If somebody just handed you an ethical system and said, here, go blindly follow it, you're now in a situation where maybe you're trying to be good, but do you really have the knowledge behind it? But if you go through it yourself, this exercise of culling from the world, synthesizing, you'll build up a little bit of knowledge as to what these mean and what the sages meant by it and how we can put this into action. So on page 2, just at the very top, I'll just touch on this really quickly, but if you look at Western philosophy over the last few centuries, there's been a lot of effort to sort of sort out all these different ethical systems. And they more or less categorize things into three sort of general systems or approaches to ethics. One is consequentialism. So that's where you got utilitarianism and that kind of idea. So you're really focused on the results. Whether something's ethical or not is generally judged in relation to the results that come from that. Deontological ethics, or ethics based on rules of action. Thou shall not, yada, yada, yada. We have a lot of that in our world. Rules that we follow. Not a bad thing, but all of these are somewhat incomplete in themselves. And then virtue ethics, or ethics based on the cultivation of virtue. Now, I was talking a couple days ago with Pablo and Michelle, and one of the topics that came up was young people today and whether they're getting sufficient education in fundamental principles. And I was thinking about this question in terms of ethics over the last couple days, and something I've discussed with friends over the last few years is the whole big rage right now in cinema is these superhero movies, right? It's been 10 years and all these different superhero movies. Now there's three characters in their superhero movies that are instructing kids in this system without the kids even really knowing it. So those three characters, if anybody knows who they are, is Iron Man, Captain America, and Thor. Right? Iron Man's a consequentialist. Captain America is a deontological ethicist, and Thor is a virtue ethicist. And what they do over the course of like 20 movies or something like that, they take these characters and they put them in a perilous situation, and you see their ethical practice play out in those situations. And you see the pros and cons and the strengths and weaknesses of each of those systems. And the only time it really works is when they're all together and synthesized. So when they stand alone and they only practice the one method, they run into serious problems. And we see that in history. You can go through history and you can find people who are just strict consequentialists, big problems. If all you're doing is focusing on virtue and you're not paying attention to anything else, you're going to run into trouble. So we've got to synthesize these. And that's what the great sages are doing. Their systems are all synthesis. They all, is that really a real word?
Synthesis?
No. Anyway, they all synthesize these approaches into one system. So, we'll just really quickly touch on consequentialism, because it's the other two that I want to focus on a little bit more in terms of practice. So, you'll see in the middle there, in nice quotations, divine consequentialism. It's a pretty big claim, but we'll play with words a little bit here. And I just picked out two to kind of fuel this this part of the talk. So, first is from Jesus, second is from Krishna. Famous statement from Jesus on how do you recognize a sage? Well, you see it from the fruits, right? That's how you recognize them. So you pay attention to the results. So you want to know if somebody's, you know, acting in harmony with nature or however you want to say it. You look at the results. That's how you're going to identify. Right? Krishna says, thy right is to the work, but never to its fruits. Let not the fruit of thy work be thy motive. Okay, so how do we tell a great sage? By their fruits. But don't make fruits your goal. Okay? So there's this kind of thing. We have to find our way, and you'll find statements from the different sages on this kind of topic. And you have to sort of bring those together and find your way down the middle. What does this actually mean in application? So one of the things, so I'll touch on kind of two points. First thing with consequentialism is we need to be very expansive in our view of results, right? And that's something that we're slowly getting to scientifically and philosophically in the West, but we're kind of still far off from these guys. You know, theosophy gives a broader view of what a human being is and our place in the universe and all of that. So we naturally will, through that kind of system, develop a bit of a broader view of results. You know, it's a lot of utilitarianism from way back in the day would say stuff like, okay, so if everybody's got clothes and food and a house, we're good, right? But are we taking care of our mental health? Are we taking care of our spiritual health? We're getting there, right? You see these changes in society now. We're getting there. We're paying more attention to how there's more to the picture than just make sure your body's not going to die, right? So we need an expansive view of results. The second part is something theosophy posits that you'll find in most of the major traditions as well, is that there's kind of an inherent harmony in nature, right? And we're coming to that point of view in, you know, scientifically speaking as well. We recognize that there's a kind of harmony in an ecosystem. Act outside of that harmony or in opposition to that harmony, and you see how the damage kind of reverberates out, right? So, for anyone who was here in the talks this last week, you'll recognize the terms anima mundi and alaya. We were talking about those ideas. The universal soul, let's say, in theosophy. There's an inherent harmony in that universal soul. Now, there's an identity between ourselves, our real spiritual essence, and that universal soul. So there's a harmony between us and the universal soul. There's a harmony between all units with each other in the universal soul, let's say. So it's that harmony that determines, from the sage's point of view, the consequentialist approach. Results are important, and results are important in an expansive way. But you don't place your desire in the result. What you do is you learn, gradually, over time, to align yourself with that harmony, and you act in alignment with that harmony, and let the results take care of themselves. It's kind of this position that you gradually are training yourself to get into that kind of position. So results matter, but don't make them the goal. That's kind of the essence of the consequentialism of the sages. So that, with that idea in mind, it's a knowledge-based action, right? It's not like we can just sit here and go, harmony, enact. So we have to learn to be in harmony. It's a learning process. And that's what the next two sections we'll deal with here is, we're going to deal with the restraints, deontological restraints, purifications, these kinds of subjects, the thou shall nots. And we're going to deal with virtues. We could just say the thou shall nots and the thou shalls, something like that. Okay. So we're going to follow HBB's advice in the second object of the Theosophical Society. We're going to go through and compare systems. This is sort of like an effort that we all can go through. And what we have in the handout here is just an example of my own effort to do this. But I think every individual needs to do it for themselves. So this is just an example. Everything will go here. Some ways in which you can gather these things and try to synthesize them. So on the next page, you see a little chart there. Now, each sage is exploring the same questions, right? Why are we troublemakers? How do we solve it? But they live in different cultures. They have different backgrounds. The people have different backgrounds. So they customize what they discover for the people they're teaching. And they each, in themselves, develop their own kind of presentation of what they feel the optimal ethical system is. And we can start pulling from those different ethical systems and find ways to see what are the similarities between these. So this chart is just kind of a very broad example of something you can go through as an exercise. You see four different systems there from Zoroaster, that's one of the oldest traditions on the planet. From Sankara, so that's the Vedic tradition, or Advaita Vedanta, non-dual tradition from India. The Buddha's system, two types of systems that go hand in hand, the Noble Eightfold Path and the Paramitas. And on the right-hand side there, we'll just say the Greek overall, comes down right through into Christianity and everything as well. You'll see these four, what they call cardinal virtues now, which we'll touch on in a minute. Now, when you line them up like this, you can kind of start to see the similarities. And if you look on the left-hand side there, you see like a nice simple division, spirit, soul, body. There's a division of a human being. And good thought, good word, good action. Nice and very, very simple and very practical, right? So each of these is kind of customed to that sage's view of the human system, what makes up a human being. And then they kind of design their ethical system around that. So you can line those up and you can see the similarities. You see, you know, all of them have sort of a along the top there, you get sort of virtues and restraints of the mind, right? Discernment, mindfulness, prudence or discrimination, dhyana. These all have, they have multiple meanings, but we're focusing on the ethical application of these terms. You know, so down at the bottom, you see the more physical. In the middle, you see the more sort of energetic, dealing with speech and such. And then you see the ones that are dealing with mind up to the more spiritual. There's this kind of natural range from the outer to the inner. So they build these ethical systems on that kind of a basis. What's a human being? Because this is what we're trying to solve, right? What's the problem with the human being? So you got to figure out what a human being is first. Once you start figuring out what a human being is, then you can try to come up with solutions to problems. Where's the problem in a human being, and how do we solve those problems? Right? So the ethics and the and our view of what a human being is always go hand in hand. Okay. So let's go through the virtues and the restraints. We're just going to do this really quickly, and then we'll get to something a lot more practical. So virtues and restraints are essentially two sides of the same coin. You could say in our process of self-improvement, we're essentially end up doing two things. There are certain things in ourselves, habits, tendencies, appetites, whatever, that need to be controlled in some manner or curbed in some manner. On the other hand, there's qualities of our being, there's powers within us that we need to develop or cultivate. So we're doing this simultaneous process of sort of like dealing with the lower that's putting us out of harmony and cultivating the higher that's getting us more in harmony. And so restraining this, cultivating this, the simultaneous process. So if you go through the restraints, one way that they get commonly divided out, you see this mostly in Patanjali, not mostly, but you see this like really clearly in Patanjali. The Patanjali, the author of the Yoga Sutras, he lays out his ethical system before any of the meditation stuff. He's got two things there. He calls them yama and niyama. Yama is just a Sanskrit word for restraint. So restraint and niyama, or inner restraint, we could say. Broadly defined, we could say social restraints and individual restraints, or inner restraints. Which brings a fundamental point to mind, that ethics isn't just about how we treat each other. It's also about how we treat ourselves. Right? So there's always that those two sides of it. And you'll see that in all of their systems, they always address those. They always address the social aspect of things and the inner aspect of things. We have to align both of those. So what you'll see here in this, over the next couple pages, we'll scan through it just really quick, is an example of me going through the exercise of culling from all the traditions around the world. So I as you go through and cull them, you kind of see they sort of naturally categorize themselves in certain ways. You know, restraint of speech, for instance. So all the different sages have something to say about speech and what aspects of speech ought to be restrained. So you see, and you can kind of group these together, eh? Continence of speech, no lying, no divisive speech, no abusive speech, no gossip, non-condemnation. They kind of naturally group themselves together. It's a certain subject, right? Go down a little further, restraint of violence. You know, there's all of them have something to say about violence and how we ought to restrain that, and what aspects we ought to restrain, and on and on and on. Those naturally group themselves together. Restraint of possession, same idea, right? Non-possessiveness, non-grasping, non-covetousness, non-greed, non-stealing, no excess. They're all addressing the same topic. restraint of consumption. We could use a bit of that. sexual restraints, no sexual misconduct, continence, right up to abstinence in some systems. So they're all addressing the same topics, and you'll see as you start to cull through them that they kind of naturally categorize themselves. One thing you can observe with the restraints is that they're essentially based on what powers a human being has. Third object of the Theosophical Society, right? Exploration of the powers in man. We have certain powers. I have the power of speech. That means I can abuse that power. Right? I have the power to grasp things. I can abuse that. I have the power to hit. You know, physical movement, that's a power. I can abuse that. For any human power, there is a restraint. Because it can be abused. So this is culling through the ethical systems of the reformers and putting them together. And this is restricted to the ones that HPB named on that quote in the front page. You can go much wider than that. Now, what we get there is the idea that, okay, so we are powerful beings. And power needs responsibility. So we need to develop ethical systems that address that power and allow us to deal with it. Most of what we're doing in the world right now is abusing these powers that we have. Right? So the restraints all categorize themselves, you'll see, naturally into this kind of system of, okay, if you can do this, then it needs to be controlled or under the supervision of our higher faculty, you could say, if you don't like the idea of control, if that's too strong of a phrase. It needs to be in its rightful place, under the supervision of our intellect, our intuition, our more spiritual aspects. Okay, so that's an example of the exercise. And if you look through all those, you know, under non-stealing, I've given you references that you can follow in different texts. So you can go to Patanjali or Buddha or Lao Tzu or Jesus and whatnot. You'll see references through all those. The virtues are the same thing. You can start categorizing the virtues. So you're culling through all the systems, gather all the they all have key virtues. You know, they all list, basically. Here's the virtues, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Go through, gather them all together, put them together, and you'll start to notice that they start to categorize themselves automatically as well. They group themselves automatically. Now, the way I've laid them out here is kind of my choice on how to organize them. And it's based on the human constitution, the theosophical constitution of man. So we start there at the top and work our way to the bottom in this thing. So you'll see archetypal or paradigmatic virtues. Paradigmatic is the Greek term. So virtues that relate to the harmony in the spiritual soul or our Atma Buddhi. These are all like fundamental key point virtues in these different in these systems. Okay? Not even necessarily virtues per se. They point at the harmony itself. So you see their justice from the Greek system. You see the Tao and Wu Wei from Lao Tzu, Asha from Zoroaster, Dharita from the Vedic, Yi from Confucius, Dharma from the Buddhist. They all share something in common, eh? Next category that seems to sort of put itself together a bit naturally, virtues that relate to our sense of self. Selflessness, humility, dignity, integrity, you could go on and on. But you see the shared meanings there. Next one, intellectual or rational virtues relating to the power of mind or manas. Right? Discernment, prudence, knowledge, self-study, introspection, mindfulness, concentration. All sharing in qualities. Eh? All related to a particular principle in man. Continue down, mental, emotional virtues. Okay, in theosophy, we'll say higher manas, lower manas. More related to lower manas, but these ones are like, okay, what if lower manas was freed from our lower sort of, you know, appetites and passions and desires that lead us astray? Okay, so what would result? Contentment, tranquility, calmness, peacefulness, comfort, ease. That word sukha, under comfort and ease, that's the opposite of dukkha, which people translate as suffering from Buddha, but dissatisfaction is a good one, so you could say satisfaction here. But you see the similarity with all those, eh? The next one, I like this kind of categorization, but this is kind of my own. And again, this is just my own It's an example. Work through them yourself. You might have totally different categorizations. So I like this idea of orientation virtues, or a wider meaning of the term asana in yoga. You know, asana means to strike a posture, right? So you can do that physically, but what's the posture of the whole of your being? Okay? So the orientation virtues are like, okay, so there's a problem in us. We're here in the middle. And I can go that way or I can go that way. You know, I can lead myself out of harmony or I can work myself towards harmony. It all depends on my orientation. Am I oriented that way or am I oriented this way? So the orientation virtues you see there, okay, so attitude or posture in regards to the higher. What do we need to do to ascend, let's say? Determination, courage, bravery, daring, fearlessness, effort, fervor, power. And you'll find that these in those systems are in that placement. Meaning, when a sage in those systems mentions these, he mentions them in the context of trying to ascend, trying to rise to the higher aspects of our nature. So what's our attitude or posture in regards to that transition from lower to higher? Desire for liberation, a huge one in the Vedanta tradition. Hope, renunciation, faith, prostration to the God within. Ishvara Pranidhana is one of the terms in Sanskrit. Ishvara is like the God within, so prostration to the God within. Loyalty, filial piety, and we'll keep going on there. What's our attitude or posture in regards to the lower, those things that we want to overcome, so to speak, or bring back into harmony? Dispassion, desirelessness, fortitude, forbearance, equanimity, withdrawal, detachment, patience, endurance. You see the similarities there. They're all directed to a certain process and a certain posture or attitude. Then kamic virtues. Kama, the principle of passions and desires. So in its lower aspects, what needs to happen there? We're trying to deal with these aspects of ourselves that bring us out of harmony. So, okay, temperance. We need to temper things. Control, restraint, remorse for transgression. I find that to be quite an interesting one. Discipline, skillful means, purity, purification. These are all related to our karmic principle and lower aspects. Okay. The last one is a categorization I like to do myself here. You could take all these following ones that are under number 6, social virtues, and you could put them into the other categories because they all relate to aspects of human being. But I like doing this, putting them all together under social virtues, because I find it more practical. And all these ones that are under this category of social virtues, they're the ones that all the sages say, this is your starting point. The very first step on the path, this is what these are. So it's good to group them together. So charity, giving, generosity, liberality, reciprocity, compassion, benevolence, mercy, gentleness, loving kindness, sympathy, empathy, support of others, defense of the internet, of the innocent. Defense of the internet? It doesn't need defense. The innocent do, though. Truth, innocence, sincerity, and on and on. So this is just an example of engaging the second object of the Theosophical Society, comparative study from all the traditions around the world, and how you can work through sort of synthesizing those ideas to give yourself a better view of what all these sages were saying about ethics. You can do it for any topic, but this is just for the ethical approach. Now, once you've done that, you've built yourself a tool belt, right? Now you have all these tools. You look through here and you see what all these things are. Okay, so I have all these restraints, all these virtues. Anybody can do a stock of themselves, self-reflect, and see maybe where their strengths or weaknesses lie and work on the weaknesses. Okay. And what we can do is we can then take those and find a way to put them into action in the world. And what I'm going to do now is just give a kind of, on the very last page here, you'll see a way of working with the cardinal virtues. These are the 4 cardinal virtues from the Greek system. They come down right through to modern times in the Christian tradition. Right? So it's a very sort of cornerstone of Western ethics, these 4 virtues. They have a cornerstone for thousands of years. Now, each one of these can be looked at as a virtue in and of itself. Justice as a virtue, prudence or discernment as a virtue, temperance as a virtue, and fortitude. But I like to approach them as kind of categories. And you'll kind of see what I mean when we go through this. They're categories within which are grouped lots of other virtues and restraints. And they're also a method that you work through. And I'll explain the logic of that method. You'll see how practical this can be. So point number one is justice or harmony. And we saw that earlier on. This is the essential harmony of nature, of which the spiritual aspect of ourselves is eternally in harmony. We just don't bring that harmony down and out into the world perfectly yet. That's what we're working on. So the divine, I know it says diving there, but that should be divine. I guess it dives. The divine impulse from within, the voice of conscience, as a representation of the inherent justice, harmony of the good, quote-unquote, informs us of the necessity for rightness in the world. We have some sort of intuition that there needs to be rightness. Everybody feels that kind of... You feel when things are out of balance. You feel when things are in balance. So we know that that's the silent voice that speaks to you. So that's going to alert you to the necessity for an ethical action. So the moment you enter into a situation, the first thing that happens is there's a silent voice that says, hey, do the right thing. So now we have that moment. Now we can pause for just a moment. The next thing we need to do is exercise the second of the four cardinal virtues, that's prudence or discernment. So the use of the intellectual principles in us allow us to engage in prudence or discernment regarding what is rightful and what is wrongful. It's one thing to say, I have this silent voice saying, do the right thing. It's another thing to know what the right thing is in any given moment. And every moment is entirely unique. So you can't just necessarily say, the rule is always this. Because every situation is unique. So you have to be able to figure out what the right thing to do is in the moment. That's the trick, right? So the second thing we do, we get that little voice of the conscience saying, you need to do the right thing. The second thing we got to do is figure out what the right thing is. The third thing to do is, once you have figured out what the right thing is, to varying degrees of accuracy, none of us are all wise, so, you know, we'll make mistakes, but okay, we generally have an idea of what the right thing to do is now. Well, now we have to do it. And that doing it is the next. Temperance. So let's say temperance as a category includes all the restraints and all the virtues that are going to be needed in that moment to do the right thing. And it's going to be unique to every situation. Maybe the situation is going to need patience. And maybe it's going to need to be, there's going to be some restraint of speech in that moment. Maybe in a totally different situation, it's a different set of virtues and restraints. But we need to put that into action. And that's what I look at as a category under temperance. Now, what happens the moment we try to do the right thing? There's resistance. So the resistance might come from without, or it might come from within. Pretty much always comes from both without and within, right? Because we're not perfect. So, you know, let's say maybe you've developed a kind of addictive pattern, a habit over time, and you want to address that. So you figure out what the right thing to do is, and you start doing it. And this little thing in you is like, do the thing you like. So you have to figure out how to deal with that. And that's forbearance. Okay? Everything, let's say, categorized under forbearance. Lots of virtues and restraints that are going to be needed to withstand the pressures that will come to try to lead you astray. The devil's going to come and tempt you as soon as you try to be right. Okay? That's how it goes. So this is a fourfold process that just illustrates what happens in the moment when we try to be ethical. So it becomes, when you start to work through it, a kind of mantra, like an ethical mantra. Justice, right? So your justice, prudence, temperance, fortitude. Justice, prudence, temperance, fortitude in the moment. Now, it's hard to know exactly what the right thing to do is just like that. And the main problem is in the discernment or the prudence, right? It's complicated. Every situation is unbelievably complicated. You can't possibly see every angle of it. You can try, though. Right? But in the moment, it's very hard to see everything that's at work in that moment. So it requires practice. So let's say today I enter a situation, and I go, okay, justice, okay, prudence, temperance, fortitude, and I do the best I can do, right? At night, before I go to sleep, I reflect back on the day. And I think, you know, I could have done this a little bit better, and now that I've had time to think about it, maybe the right thing to do is maybe like this. Okay? So then the next time I'm in a similar situation, justice, prudence, yeah, I got that, temperance, fortitude, act. And then again, review, and over and over. It's just like practicing a sport, or a martial art, or piano, or whatever, right? It takes practice. The more you practice it, the faster you get. You know, the more you practice it, the quicker you're going to go. You're going to enter a situation, you're going to go, justice, prudence, got it, temperance, fortitude, got it. You get better and better and better and better at it. Until you're essentially acting spontaneously, in harmony, and that's the sage. Well, that's essentially the skill set of a sage. You know, spontaneously harmonious action requires training and knowledge. It doesn't come automatically. All the sages can act in those moments. They're like conduits for that harmony into the world, right? But that's because however many lives and how much practice to work this out. So this methodology, I find, is a really good practical way of doing, of sorting through this. And, you know, this is drawing from the Greek system, from the Western system, but you can do the same with any of the other ones. You'll see these kind of patterns. Like, they really address what actually happens in the moment when I try to do the right thing. And you can follow yourself through that moment. So when you're working with this little ethical mantra in your mind as you're stepping through the day, you'll catch little things. You'll catch yourself in a moment. You'll get a little bit more discernment on a certain subject. You'll figure out, I know I wasn't really getting this virtue in there very much. I gotta cultivate that more. I wasn't really retaining this part of me. I gotta deal with that. Over time, perfect that more and more and more. Well, that's essentially the path of a sage in the ethical department. So that's what we end up with. And that's what, let's see if we go back now to, we'll finish off with this here. Go back to page 6, bottom of page 6 over to page 7, the very beginning of the virtues there. That ability of the sage to act seemingly spontaneously in harmony is what all the sages highlight as like their sort of keynote feature in terms of action in the world. So in the Vedas it's called Rita, in Buddhism you have Dharma, okay? In the moment, working through the moment. You have the Tao or Wu Wei from Lao Tzu. Wu Wei is like, it's literally that working in harmony with nature. Like you are walking with that harmony. You are that harmony. The same with Asha from the Zoroastrians. It's essentially the same meaning. And this is the expansive meaning of the term justice, or translated in the Bible usually as righteousness. It's the same word in the Greek, by the way. Justice and righteousness. Dikaiosune in the Greek. I'm probably mispronouncing that. It's essentially what Jesus means by the kingdom of God, right? The kingdom of God on earth, especially if you take it from like Tolstoy's perspective, the way he deals with the kingdom of God is within you, you know, and how we bring that into the world. So they all give this kind of high exemplification in these single words, what it means to master this. This means you are the Tao when you master this. You're like a worker for nature. You are nature, and you are in harmony with nature. As it currently stands, we are nature, and we are in harmony in nature, in the highest aspect of our beings, in our being. But we haven't fully learned to exemplify that in our waking condition and our shared social life. But these tools, I think, can go a long way, especially that last bit about those four key points in the Greek system. They go a long way to helping us work through that. So, yeah, that's pretty much it. There's some other stuff, but yeah, we'll stop there. That's a good place to end. Thanks.
I have a question.
meditation with their acquisitions and deprivations?
A little bit, but I'm not that familiar with it.
Ah, because, yeah, that when you were saying the thou shalt nots and the thou shalt, that's right where she gets in there. Mm-hmm. And then she adds in a meditation, sitting meditation, mm-hmm. kind of to wrap it all in and build the ground substance. So that's exactly
what. So this is what we can add into our, in addition to the review at the end of the day,
right.
of looking at things, we can add in meditation like that to,
right.
yeah.
Right. No, this was very nice.
Cool. Go ahead.
So this approach, would that apply to people who are living largely in their personality? And if once you get up to people who are in their higher self, it'd be a total different approach. Maybe through intuition they would know what to do?
Maybe, but I tend to take the approach that what we call intuition, we don't arrive at without serious effort and training and practice. So I always take that approach. I mean, I don't know because I'm in the condition I'm in, and it's not that great a condition, let's be honest. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know how a sage would look at it. You know, maybe their point of view on all of this is quite different than my own or our own. But I really try to focus in on that. I think it's a developed thing. You know, that it seems spontaneous, and I think it kind of, you could say it is spontaneous from a sage. You could say the intuition is just there, the action is just there, it's all automatic, they're just like a conduit. But a part of me goes, yeah, but you don't get there automatically. Like, you get there through training. So in a sense, I think, okay, like a martial artist, right? First days, you're trying to do this, and you're getting beat up, and you don't know what's going to happen. Later on, you're not even thinking. Your body is naturally doing it for you, right? But you don't get there without years of effort and training. That it seems spontaneous and automatic, right? That's my approach, anyway.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Thoughts, questions? Go ahead.
I came across an interesting idea recently in reading. I think it may have been in Pablo's book, that conscience only tells you what not to do, but it can't direct you as to what to do.
Yeah. Yeah, that was how Socrates described his daimon, eh? Yeah, it's daimon, or voice of conscience. It only ever told him what not to do and not what to do. I think it seems like that is pretty much how the voice of conscience works. In my experience, you know, you end up asking over and over, what am I supposed to do? But it's more like when you start making a misstep, then it's, oh, okay, now I hear. Now stop. So there's something to that, I think, for sure. I think the thou shall part, the like what to do part, is the part that really takes the practice and experience, and it's like a long-term development of wisdom that way. Yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to add to what Doug was saying. I long time ago, I asked the High Lama about the same question. Can you just break through, have this awakening, and sustain it, actually, not just have glimpses and fall back, and he said, sure, after many, many, many lights and little steps, you have that explosion, but there's a lot of practice.
Yeah. I like the way you said that, because that's, I think, you know, in my own little way, my experience as well, I think everybody experiences that. It's like, you can get flashes, a flash of intuition, or like, you know, these kinds of things, but to maintain that, it's much more difficult. That's, it must take lifetimes of practice.
Doesn't it seem like key point of the voice of the silence is that what we think of as the voice of conscience, which for most of us is very fleeting, temporary, and tells us what not to do, as opposed to what to do, is that as you progress spiritually, it becomes an instructor. And that there's one point in the SD where HPB connects the voice of Kuan Yin, which we connect with the Logos and with the Akasha, as being represented in the human being as the voice of conscience. And that as that expands and grows, as we listen to it and make use of it, it becomes something that, it becomes a form of knowledge, right? It's a form of knowing at a very high level and which would also correspond with self-conscious spirituality, self-conscious unity with our spiritual nature. So it seems like it's initially it may be just keeping us from doing that thing that we should not do, but eventually the promise is, it seems, that we'll know. It'll be full knowing, conscious knowing.
Yeah, and you see that, you know, taught in the different systems, and you see it exemplified in the stories of the sages as well. You know, at a certain point, it's a very like one-on-one relationship with that voice of consciousness. And I think you can go in the other direction as well. So if the voice of conscience is coming up and you keep ignoring it, then it gets quieter and quieter. You put it into a box in the corner, and then when you need it, it's not, you know, because you blocked it off, so to speak. So there's a possibility of sort of going in either direction. But it's a really good point, and it, clearly in the voice of the silence, that approach is taken. Right?
Well, and it also points to what was mentioned by another questioner, the importance of meditation in relation to ethics. And that in the Buddhist system, you get that threefold division of Sila, Samadhi, and Prajna. Yeah. All three are needed, really, for the ascent. Seems to be connected with that idea as well.
Yeah, I look at it as like, okay, so if we want to be in harmony with the universal soul, and we want to be, you know, tied into that natural harmony, then it's not just book learning, so to speak. It's also mindfulness, which comes through meditation. It's like stilling the mind. That doesn't mean emptying the mind. Stilling the mind, focus, that kind of stuff. It really goes a long way. And I think, you know, without that kind of mindfulness, without all those parts together, like this is the whole thing, right? It's a synthesis. You take one part out, and you're going to be lopsided. So you have to find ways to bring that whole synthesis together. I think Maria had her hand up, and then Bobby.
Yeah, it seems to me that when we're more clear in any situation about what not to do, what's not acceptable, and we can let that be, then a whole new level of options that might be possible are revealed to us little by little. The challenge is not to focus on the goal, but really to focus on the process. And once we know what is acceptable, the goal may change. We may actually choose to move in another direction that will lead us to where we really should be, rather than what we imagine should be the goal. Yeah. So I really like the idea of just becoming more sensitive to what's really not appropriate in most situations.
Yeah. And you see that with a lot of the systems, the way they lay things out, is like they'll heavily emphasize certain restraints off the very beginning. Like, okay, so you need to learn not to do this, not to do that. And the basics, like don't steal, don't kill, don't da da da, right? Okay, so let's start there. So let's start, you determine what not to do. And then in that space, having known what not to do, then like you say, the field of what to do opens up.
Right.
And then that's where we really have our challenge, because that's the, in a sense, the more difficult part is to figure out what actually to do. Pablo?
Yeah, regarding these two sources you were talking about, I think HPV says that the voice of conscience comes from the higher ego, from the soul, and it's a result of the accumulated experience. So we know what not to do because it happened in the past, but with new situations, that is not enough. And then she talks about the possibility of a buddhimana, so a spiritual intuition. And that's the one that brings a perception of what is truth, what to do. So we have these two elements. And as you say, as we grow, then we enter in touch with buddhimanas, or the light of the logos.
I think the word of the terminology of like self-consciously listening to that voice is kind of the key thing. I mean, like, what we're trying to develop in our human journey right now is a higher degree of genuine self-consciousness. Mm-hmm. And that takes time, and there's degrees of that. It's a progression. So it makes sense in that kind of context that, let's say that when we first start listening to the voice of conscience, we're dealing with probably the lowest level of that part of our being. And as we listen more, like Kirk was saying, it gets more pronounced and more pronounced and more pronounced. And then, like you say, there's maybe this switch in there of like, okay, this deals with from our learning, from what we've learned over time, and here's a more universal, I suppose, aspect. And I think that's, let's just say the higher or highest voice of conscience that we may have access to is essentially our connection to that universal soul. So it's more of a universal than an individual voice. But yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I experienced a beautiful example of someone's conscience telling them what not to do, but at the same time telling them what to do. I was visiting with a friend, someone in the hospital, and my friend lost her phone. And she realized it, you know, like half an hour later. And so anyway, we went down to the lost and found, and sure enough, someone had turned in her phone. But the man who worked there told us that that morning someone had turned in $8,000 to the lost and found that was in a pack. Hmm. And I thought, wow, that's a very validating experience of what not to do, but what to do.
That's a good example.
Yeah,
we need to pay attention.
Yeah.
Pay attention to is, you know, that's that mindfulness aspect. Jerry, and then we'll go back.
In the list of virtues and vices, I didn't see the word gratitude or ingratitude. And there's a famous expression from the Mahatmas that ingratitude is not one of our vices.
Mm.
We also have that expression too, that if we take one step in their direction, speaking of Mahatmas, they'll take one in ours. What's the role of gratitude in this ethical scheme that you're talking about?
That's a really good question. Yeah. To me, that's, you know, we could take gratitude and categorize it in, and I would put it with all the sort of like key social virtues there where we're dealing with other human beings. How do we approach them? So, you know, I have reciprocity in there, for example, that's in the same territory. I think there's kind of a couple of versions of gratitude, we could say. That there's a sort of personal gratitude, individual level gratitude, that I think is really important to cultivate so that we stay in the right mindset in reference to other people. But like I said, there's ethics has to cover our relations to other people and our relations to ourselves. And I look at the, let's say, the gratitude and that sort of whole realm of ideas that are all interlinked together with that topic, that there must be a sort of inherent gratitude cultivated over time that's more abstract. Like, more in reference to, like, prostration comes close when you really think about what they mean by that, because they don't mean me prostrating myself in front of another person. I'm prostrating myself in front of my higher self. And part of that attitude is the sort of gratitude for the voice of conscience directing you in the right way, or other people helping you on that pathway. Nobody does anything alone. So that's a good one. I think it's really important. It's not a term that I came across as like a specific concept on its own in culling through, but that doesn't mean it's not there, for sure. It's there in those systems.
First of all, I'd like to thank you for your matrix and all the comparison stuff. And all the explanations that come in the back here, you've done quite a thorough study. One thing that I kind of feel maybe you could add to it, or at least explore, is that there's actually two major dual paradigms. One is the one which seems to be stressed through the conversation tonight, which is it's on our head to kind of figure it out. And the other paradigm is, the sages, the way I understand it, is that you as a human being, because you have four flaws, propensity to cheat, propensity to make mistakes, you have imperfect senses, and the propensity to fall into illusion, there's no way you're going to figure it out. That's the other paradigm. And they both have their advantages and disadvantages. The first one is you're constantly struggling with all these questions of, is this really the right thing, or is it just my mind and we see all sorts of people who are maybe not so mentally stable, really convinced that what they're doing is the right thing when in fact they're flying planes in the World Trade Center. So the other side of the coin is that if you then surrender to the wrong type of teacher or guru or whatever, then you got a real big problem there.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, but there are two different world paradigms, and in conclusion, I'd say one of them is referred to as the way the cat raises her child. The cat basically picks the baby cat up with her mouth and carries it to wherever she wants to go because they're tiny, and she doesn't bite it. She moves the cat. Whereas the monkey doesn't do that. The monkey, the baby monkey, has to hang on to the monkey's the body of the parent monkey. Mm-hmm. So they have their advantages and disadvantages, but there are two different world paradigms, and it would be nice if you could integrate that into your chart a little bit.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's a good point, because like you say, the one was more addressed and the one was not as addressed. The one that wasn't as addressed kind of ends up tying into the whole idea of wise men or teachers or whatnot. And like what Jesus was saying, how do you recognize a legit from a non-legit? It's also heavily, that other paradigm is also heavily dependent upon discernment or prudence. You know, we have to really learn to exercise that. I don't view these ethical systems as isolated things that an individual can do on their own. Because we don't live on our own. I don't have my own planet, and that's it. Right? So it's all in concert. So it's in concert with each other. We learn from each other. We exchange. We grow together. It's in concert with the voice of the silence or the God within, or however we want to view that. It's in concert with great teachers and all of them. So in a certain respect, well, yeah, it's all on our shoulders. We've got to figure it out. But we're not alone. So in a sense, those two paradigms, you can bring them together.
All right, thank you so much. We are very grateful. Okay, real quick, this week at Cortona School, we have integrating the spiritual with the daily life, and that is through journaling and art. No, yeah.